Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the SOM TV podcast. My name is Jason Wise. Before we get going, I have to say thank you to all of you for really making this thing blow up. I don't think any of us were really prepared for the response that these podcasts have gotten, so thank you so much. If you guys keep listening, we will keep making them. Today is very, very special for me. I sit down with Jay Fletcher, who is a master sommelier based out of Aspen, who has trained some of, in my opinion, the most talented wine professionals working today. Among those, Dustin Wilson, who's over at Verve Wine in New York and San Francisco, Sabato Segaria, who heads Bar Taco. Jay has kind of been behind mentoring those and many, many, many other people. But what a lot of people don't know about Jay outside the industry is his story. Jay started as a pool hustler, and he has just got a story you can't make up if you try. It's just insane. Jay is with an organization called SOM Foundation. They are not a sponsor of this podcast. I just think they are a fantastic organization. SOM Foundation does scholarships and enrichment trips, and it's open to everybody. So go to somfoundation.com and you can sign up to try to be a part of these scholarships and enrichment trips. And they have a great website with a bunch of educational stuff. And also go to somtv.com, which will be the home of all of our future streaming video material from stuff we left out of the films, our new shows, all sorts of educational content. We'll be launching that August 4th. Without further ado, my conversation with Jay Fletcher. When I made the first film, SOM, there was this elusive character that I really wanted to get. It seems like it's Fred Dame in the movie, but Fred I worked with from the very beginning, kind of in some capacity. But you, Jay, who is sitting here with me at Aspen Food and Wine, were not so easy. I had a tough time with you at the beginning of making SOM. And I want to start this because you are now one of my favorite human beings I've ever met in the entire wine world. You are one of the most competitive people I've ever met, and you have some of the best stories of anybody I've ever met in the wine world. So this is going to be an interesting podcast to talk to you. But I want to start it with how you and I met. I was filming the very first days of SOM 1, which would have been in 2011, maybe? Does that sound right?
Or 10, maybe. Or 10. Was it Meadowood? You were 10 or 11, maybe?
It was Meadowood, and I was filming Ian Cobble at Correct. His exam. I didn't even know if I had a film. I didn't know what I was doing. I had never made a film in my life. Okay, so that's my...
Well, for me, you know, I had heard about you from Brian McClinic before, and, you know, he had asked... It talked about that a little bit, but you got to remember that at the time I was chairman of the Court of Master Sommeliers, and we were going through basically not a revolution, but we were having issues with the European chapter. At the time, we were all one chapter, and the European side of it was a bit one-sided with the way they wanted things done. And at the time, we had actually more members in America. And so I just wanted some parity, and I wanted some clarity on the exams. I didn't feel that the exams were being vetted quite correctly for continuity and modern law, because some of these wine laws change daily. And, you know, we wanted to have as much integrity as possible. So I put in an examination committee, and I changed some of the things that we had done in the past. And so it was a little bit troublesome with the board of directors. Some of them believed in what I was doing and some of them didn't. And so when I had you rolling in, you know, with cameras, it's the last thing that I needed was some clown with a camera messing up my show. So I basically told you to stay away and be out in the parking lot, and I didn't want really any part of you because I had too much pressure on me as it was, and I was really, really concerned about.
So you threw me out of filming, and I remember this was probably one of the best things that ever happened because it was at the very beginning, and when I got tossed from filming that MS exam, it made me so hungry to make this film. I realized there's something in there people don't want me to see or film or it's going to be hard to get. And that's the kind of thing as a documentary filmmaker, you start going, there's a story here. You know, there's something here. And obviously some worked. I mean, to some extent, as far as a movie goes, it worked. And I have a career now because of that film. And it's been an amazing, amazing journey. And I've met some of my favorite people I've ever met. But when I finally got to sit down and interview you, your interview is my favorite interview in the entire movie. And then what you do at the end of the film when you pass Dustin, I think is the emotional, it's the glue of the whole film.
Did okay this time. Did all right here. We We got through that theory part, which is great. You know, okay. That's awesome. You did an awesome job on that theory. And, you know, tasting, you're going to have to be working with tasting. You're going to have to be working with those candidates that you're going to be training from now on, Master. Okay?
Woo!
Congratulations, brother. You made it, all that hard work, and you finally brought it to the promised land, all right?
Dustin cries, you cry. I mean, that was an incredibly crazy.
Well, you got to remember, too, that, you know, there's certain protocol that we stand by, and we, you know, we do stand by integrity with those exams, and we try to do things by the book. And so having anyone film any part of the exam itself was, you know, totally forbidden. And, you know, we don't want to have somebody have an insider look at what we do. We wanted it to be, you know, a fair-up exam. So even, you know, the interview that I had with you, it was the Rudd Roundtable, and I had old and rare wines from the Johnson Cellar that night, if you recall. We did that beautiful dinner with, boy, we had some really, really unbelievable old and rare wines.
So just one little tangent about that. You opened up a Cuvée Catalan out of a, I believe, a 3-liter. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But this would be a bottle of wine that would be worth, what, 5 to 7, 8 grand? I don't even know. I couldn't.
Oh, that probably is worth about $30,000.
Okay, so I'm way off.
Yeah, that's a very, very expensive and rare bottle, large format.
And this $30,000 bottle of Cuvée Catalan, what you don't know is that's the bottle that made me make the second film. Because I interviewed Chav, Jean-Louis Chav, who made that wine in that film. And I had never had a wine like that. That was the first time in my life I had ever had a wine that was A, worth so much money, but B, so transcendentally good. I mean, it was something I just never tasted anything like it.
That wine was so pure. I mean, pure animal. And when you got that in your nose, there's a, you know, this kind of blood sage smell that comes with these Rhone wines, this granitic animal thing that it's just very, very pure with Chav. So that was really cool. That was a good.
You were the first person that ever poured me a glass of wine like that.
Well, that was the first time I actually trusted you. I had a certain amount of distrust with what you were doing to start with because I didn't really know what you were doing and I didn't know how you were going to portray our organization.
Sure.
And I, you know, I have a lot of pride with the Quartermaster Sommeliers. I was on the board 12 years before I was chairman. I've been teaching classes forever and I didn't want to be I didn't want the organization portrayed in a poor light. So I wasn't quite sure what you were doing when you were filming.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I don't know that I knew what I was doing.
You know, Fred said, you know, to give you a chance and would you mind filming the Rudd Roundtable, which of course is our best students that have passed the advanced exam plus some.
And for reference to anybody who's listening to this, that's when DeLynn goes to the table and Fred.
I want you to convert this one.
To Celsius?
Cold.
Cold. Well, yes, indeed.
Cold.
I mean, that scene's funny, where Fred's messing with DeLynn about getting the wine cold.
It's
funny. I mean, look, I often wonder if you guys behave differently if there were no camera, but I don't think so. I think, you know, messing with each other and doing all this stuff is...
We do it all the time.
Pretty normal, right?
I mean, we have a pretty good time. There's a great camaraderie. But it was really the first time that I had one-on-one with you, and as you know, I used to hustle pool. And
we're going to get to that.
Well, just to go, you know, a little corollary here. I at one time thought it was my only skill in life, and
pool.
Yes, I didn't really think I had any other skills, and I always asked the gods, why this skill? Why not teach me how to play the guitar or the trombone or be a writer? Why did I have this propensity to shoot balls in the hole? And as I traveled the country, and playing pool for money on the road is a vicious way to survive.
Why? What's?
Well, everyone is against you. If you don't win, you don't eat. You're not playing for. I didn't have any money. You know, you're scraping for nickels. You're playing guys for $2. You're playing them for $10. It's not like I was playing for $1,000 a game. And you go into these places where everyone hates you, and they want you to go down, and they'll, you know, it's just. you go into a strange pool hall, you're the enemy. The whole place wants you to go down. But later in life, I learned how to read men. And that's what I realized from all that, that I could find, I could tell the sucker, the evil man, the cheat, you know, and I learned to read men by looking at them. And I'm still really pretty good at that. I became a very good judge of character. And after doing that interview with you, I realized that you were a good man and had a good heart. And I wasn't worried about what you were going to do from that point on because I trusted my judgment of you.
Man, I mean, that means a tremendous amount for me. I mean, I have a lot of respect for you guys. And I think fear is not the right word. I think respect. I think I have been treated, I've been given a film career by you, by your trust. And I've never, you guys never, especially you, never ever meddled in what I was doing. The minute, like you said, the minute you said it, look, I trust, I got to make some without anybody telling me what to do. It was an amazing experience. I mean, as a first-time filmmaker, it's kind of the craziest thing you can get as a gift is to go make this film, do it right, be honest, and don't be a dick, which is pretty much what I was asked. Just don't be a dick. Don't, if something, you know, and that movie's funny. It's not like everyone's portrayed perfectly in it.
No, there's some great stuff in it. But at the time, you know, first of all, Fred told me that you were trustworthy. And I trust Fred. So Fred's done some nice things for me over the years and basically kind of mentored me with some different programs and let me speak at different events and invited me to help him teach classes and things like that in different places around the country. And so when Fred told me that you were solid and a good man, I believed him, but I really had to meet you myself.
Yeah.
I think the first time I met you, I pushed you out. I didn't even talk to you, so I had no idea what your character was. But after that interview, and that was a long interview, by the way, considering I had already hiked John Muir Woods, had two bottles of wine at lunch at the Buckeye Roadhouse, and suited up for that interview. I think it was an over an hour interview. And then we had dinner together, and we had a really good time. And so that really kind of started our relationship off in what I'd say, our modern relationship.
I mean, it was, so before we get into kind of your story, which I think is, if you can find a better storyteller than you, I want to meet him. But before we do that, it was, the third Somm film, it was so great to bring you back into that film and have you blind taste Fred and all that stuff. I mean, I think one thing to talk about is that tasting with Fred.
I put it in Northern Rhone. I'd say Cote Roti or Hermitage. Cote Roti is kind of what I really like because it's so peppery and meaty. Very high quality producer.
So final call, Cote Roti. What's the final vintage call?
I'll give it 95.
That's pretty good, Fred. That's pretty good.
Is Fred really as good a blind taster as we say? I mean, I've gotten, you know, on social media, everybody came at me like, is this real? Did Fred really kill these wines?
He nutted that Cote Roti. I laughed right there, you know, just because he, you know, he batted around the bush and then he came out with the vintage and, you know, he didn't call the producer. But Fred is a great, one of the greatest tasters I've ever seen. And Fred is, you know, actually he used the system on that wine where typically Fred's what I call an instinctual taster and not an analytical taster. Fred just has this photographic memory that he remembers things. Fred can do some crazy stuff. And I've seen him pick up glasses of wine and just call them by smelling them. It's just the way it is. You know, for me, I have to break them down. I have to think about it a little bit and I weigh everything in. I'm much more analytical in the way I taste. And a lot of the competitiveness that really comes in with me, basically from having to, you know, grow up on the street with no money and scrape for a living, those kind of skill sets come in really handy for examinations because you have to have wherewithal, you have to have backbone, you have to have no fear, and you know that everyone's against you and you have to persevere. So those skills have helped me a lot and it's helped me train so many people with those kind of mindsets to go in there and be the tiger, take it, don't be afraid. You know, I have great skill. You know, I say practice makes perfect. Confidence is all. Is so you, and you know the rules. Like just like any game, life's a game. You know, first of all, you have to know the rules,
if you don't know the rules, you're not going to win. And second of all, you have to practice over and over, and then you have to believe in yourself. And if you're lacking in any of those things, you will not survive in life, or especially in one of our tasting exams or service exams.
So what's the difference between cockiness and confidence?
Well, I would say that cockiness is someone that's sure of themselves that lacks skill, and confidence is someone that's sure of themselves that has skill, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. All right, so take me back to, you're in Wisconsin, you're a young man. Why did you get into pooling? Why was that the way you were going to make your money? I mean, to me, this sounds like, why not just be a construction worker? I mean,
I grew up, my father was a pool player. My father was Air Force champion. He actually played in exhibition with Willie Moscone, who was one of the great pool players. And we had a table in the basement, and he kind of showed me rudimentary bridges and things like that. He didn't really want to show me how to play. He just wanted to shoot. And playing straight pool, you might not shoot for a half hour or 45 minutes. You know, you can run 100-plus balls. So I goofed around in the basement, and I was 12, 13 years old, and I got decent with it. And then I started going downtown. I was in downtown Madison, and my parents had a failing marriage. It was hippie days. It was in the 60s. You know, I remember being at the 68 riots in downtown Madison, Wisconsin, with the protesters and the bricks and rocks throwing and tear gas. And I was in sixth grade. You know, I was there screwing around with the hippies and, you know, being downtown in Madison. But they had a pool hall down there named, it was called Action Billiards. And there was this guy named Jerry Bryseth that ran it. And Jerry, he was a very, very famous road player and a very, very accomplished pool player. He had this place called Action Billiards. And so the first time we went downtown, I think my friend Fred and I went down, and we took these college kids for $2. And Jerry was on the counter, and he just laughed. He said, these kids took you. You know, we that was their first money. We played doubles eight ball. We beat these college kids out of $2, and he laughed so hard. And then he the next year he opened a modern billiard facility called Cunique Billiards, and Cunique had 28 full-size Brunswick Gold Crown tables. And a pool table is always twice as wide as it is long. So they were 4.5 by 9 competition tables. So I started working for him, cleaning the pool room in the morning and doing maintenance on cues and things like that. Well, as it turned out, you know, this place was a mecca for all the great players in America. And we're talking the early 70s there. Everyone came through this place, and we had big tournaments and competitions and things like that. And so I started to train with Jerry, and Jerry started to teach me how to the finer arts of pocket billiards. And so during my high school years, I used to hang out down there, and I'd skip school, and I'd go down to the pool hall. I just was fascinated with the whole thing. And so because of that, I lacked in education. And at the same time, my parents' marriage was falling apart, and I didn't really have a greatest home life. So the pool hall was my home. And there was all sorts of crazy characters that hang out at this place, and all sorts of crazy things that went on, and lots of competition. And so as I got older into high school, I became more and more proficient with the game and played in tournaments and things like that. And when I was 17, I won the state championship for the junior state championship, so under 20. But I was a pretty good competitive player. My father moved out of the house when I was maybe 15, and my mother got remarried when I was 18. Now, for me, I was somewhat of an adventurer as well. When I got out of high school, 4 of us went up north of the Canadian border, and then we got dropped off on the Canadian border, and we paddled in the wilderness for 69 days. And I paddled almost 700 miles in a canoe and lived on, you know, like a month at a time without any refuel. And it was...
What were you eating? You're hunting? You're...
No, we brought dried soup mixes and things like that, oatmeal, wheatmeal, nuts, candy, you know. So we started out with 150 pounds of food in the canoe. And, you know, it was really, really vicious up in Ontario. I went up into the boundary, north of the boundary waters into Quetico Park, and then paddled all the way through Quetico Park. So it was a journey of pain, bugs. We'd paddle 10 straight hours a day, fighting whitecaps, survival. And as a young kid that really didn't have a lot of wilderness skills, this really tempered me for the rest of my life as an adventurer. It was awesome. And so I came back to Madison after being up north all summer, and I was just 18, and I got a job as a busboy in a restaurant, which also was one of the foundations of my career when I look back to it. I had a great mentor at this restaurant. His name was Terrence, and he was English. And Terrence was a Renaissance man, and he was a great beverage guy. And he took me from a busboy and taught me how to be a bartender and taught me how to make all the classic drinks. And back in the day, he was squeezing fresh orange juice, lemon juice, grapefruit juice. We had an espresso machine. We're talking 1975. This is way ahead of its things. He had 6 different beers on tap and things like that. So I didn't realize it at the time, but he put a little implant on me and taught me cocktails and things like that. So I went through the winter, that winter working, and then I got like a wanderlust. I'd never seen the ocean, so I decided that I was going to see the ocean. So I hitchhiked from Madison, Wisconsin to the Gulf, and I went down to Gulf Shores down there in Florida in the Panhandle. And a white boy from Wisconsin had never seen any sun. I didn't even know what sunscreen is, right? So I hitchhiked there with a friend of mine that immediately burned my whole face and head off. I mean, it was pretty hilarious. My ears peeled, my face peeled. But I saw the ocean. You know, I had this trail. I always had this wanderlust, and I'd never seen the ocean. So I saw the ocean in a hard way. And then from there, I decided my father had moved to New York State. So I said, well, I'll hitchhike up to New York. So I hitchhiked from Florida to New York. And ended up there in New York State, Rochester. He was in that area. And then I hitchhiked from Rochester back to Wisconsin. And so that was like one of my first big trips. After that, I worked at a place called the Spring Green Restaurant, which was a Frank Lloyd Wright restaurant. And my friend Dave, who was a pool player, told me, let's go on the road and let's try to gamble and make a living. So I sold everything I had, took a bus from Madison, Wisconsin to Tucson, Arizona. I had $500 in my name. And I bought a car with Dave. We split the car. It was $350. So you can see what I got left. My $175 out of that. I'm down to a couple hundred dollars. And we played every single city in the South. We played Tucson. We crushed Tucson. We beat everybody in Tucson. And actually beat everybody in the whole town. We made quite a bit of money there. And back in the day, you know, we might have made $800 or something like that. But
is it dangerous? I mean, are people?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, depends. So, like, bars are more dangerous than pool halls, but pool halls, the guys play better. So eventually, there was a guy in town named Billy the Airman. And Billy the Airman, he was an ex-Air Force kid, and he was the best player in town. And we knew it, because once you go in, you start to smell it out. And you got to remember, we were navigating. There weren't any maps or anything. So you'd go to a phone booth, pull out the billiard section, circle them on the map there was in the, and then just navigate around town and try to find these different places. And then people would tell you where there was a bar game going on and things like that. Now, at bars at night, that's difficult because alcohol is involved and egos are involved. But that's also where you find people that aren't that smart. It's a little easier money, right?
Right.
But anyway, we played.
But you also find people that'll beat the shit out of you.
Oh,
there.
No. You have to be very, very careful. There's certain types of people that you just want to totally avoid to get back to me reading people's character, right?
Yeah.
So we played Tucson, Phoenix, and then we did San Francisco, L.A., back across to Arizona again. Then we did Houston, Galveston, New Orleans, Baton Rouge, Miami, St. Pete, Tampa, and, you know, we just went on the road, and we made it, I think, 4 months on that trip, and then we finally, gamblers sooner or later lose, so we busted out, and we had to limp back home to Madison, and I only thing had left was my equity in the car, and it was actually a 1967 Buick Grand Sport worth a ton of money right now. And I sold my half back to Dave for $125 and got a job at a Chinese restaurant, tenant bar. The Cathay House, I think it was called. And I worked that winter, and that was 77. And then 78, I decided that I didn't want to be in Madison anymore, so I sold everything I had and put it in a backpack, and I hitchhiked north to northern Wisconsin. I walked across northern Wisconsin by myself in late May.
froze my butt off. Then I ended up hitchhiking up to Grand Marais, Minnesota. I got a job planting trees with the Forest Service. And I was up there a couple months. I go, okay, I'll be a forester. I didn't really have any life. And I ran out of work. They didn't have any work. And my friend was living in Aspen, and he'd been writing me letters. So I said, oh, well, I'll hitchhike to Aspen. So I hitchhiked from Grand Marais across North Dakota. That was a trip. North Dakota, like, they're all scared of me. Nobody picked me up. It took me 3 days to get across North Dakota. I basically walked across that thing. Then I hitchhiked into Yellowstone Park. I walked into Yellowstone Park late May, neck deep snow. I took a beating, but I basically walked through Yellowstone Park by myself. And then I hitchhiked into Aspen June 1st, 1978. And after that, I did concrete work, and I was going to be a construction guy. So I did concrete work. I worked at the lumber yard. I was an electrician. And I hurt my right knee, and I couldn't work anymore, and I started playing pool again. And I had a cast on my right leg from my hip to my ankle. I blew my right knee out. But I would balance on one leg and play pool. And I started to play really, really well again. And I ended up winning quite a bit of money here. In Aspen, there's people a little bit more affluent. And there was a guy that actually ran a marijuana smuggling ring. And he used to play pool a lot. And him and his boys used to like playing with me. It was really, really easy money. But he was really a tough player. And I had to spot him a bunch of weight. But I played him one night we played for 20 straight hours. And I beat him out of $10,000. And at that point, I'd never seen more than $3,000 or $4,000 in my life ever. And I had, when I walked into the game, I had $500. When I walked out, I had $10,000 cash. And that was a big deal for me. And so he didn't like the fact
What's it like taking somebody's $10,000? I mean, that must have been a hard...
Feels great, if which is what it feels. You know, this guy, he just went to his safe and just gave me a stack. I came home to my roommates and I said, I think we should go out to dinner. And I pulled this horse wad out of my pocket and started fanning hundreds out there. And they were just like, would you rob the bank or something? So I realized that maybe I'd start playing pool a little bit, and he flew in three-time world champion Larry Liscotti, Larry the Lizard. And the Lizard was, in 1975, had an edict he would play anyone in the world for $500,000 with no takers. I mean, he was one of the greatest pool players of all time. So...
Larry the Lizard.
Larry the Lizard, Larry Liscotti, look him up. The Prince of Pool. He wore lizard skin shoes. He was a New Jersey or Brooklyn guy with an accent, and he shot the eyes off the balls. And so we set up a match with Larry, and we played the first person to get 15 games ahead, playing nine ball for $5,000. And I don't know if you know how to play nine ball, but it's a game of rotation where you have to shoot them in order one through nine. And the guy that makes the nine ball is the winner. But because Larry was three-time world champion, I got him to spot me at the seven ball, meaning that if I made the seven or the nine, I would win. But you got to remember, this is a guy that never misses, you know, one of the greatest players in the world. And so after we played 8 hours, and at 7 hours, he had me down, I think, 13 games. Two more games, I'm going to lose the 5,000. And I broke and ran seven racks in a row on him and took it back down. So at the end of the night, he was only up three games. So we played another day, and we had 150, 200 people surrounding us, money flying, side betting, and I played great. And I lose three games each night. And so I lost, I think, about $1,000 to him. And I won it all back in a ring game later that night. So it was actually really a great confidence booster. So I started playing pool again. The thing is, with a pool game, your reputation precedes you. So I went on the road again, and because people know who you are. I mean, people know who you are in Denver. They know who you are in Albuquerque. You're marked. And they won't play you. So I went on the road, and I played. I ended up in L.A., and I was in L.A. Billiards, and I played this guy, Ron Rosas. And I didn't realize who Ron Rosas was, but Ron Rosas was the best player in L.A. And, you know, that's something to be said in a town of that size, right? And we started playing like $20 game nine ball, and I got him stuck. So we played for about 5 hours and broke even. So that night I came back and I played some old man straight pool for like $300 a game, and my luck changed. It was a weird roll of fate. And I think about it sometimes as to what really happened to me there. But the balls started to hang. I got some weird rolls, and it just didn't go well for me. So I lost maybe $1,000 that night. I went to Phoenix, I lost. I came back to Aspen, I lost. And when a gambler loses, he has no other option but to find a job. And I found a job at a French restaurant, and the rest is history. And I think about it sometimes, and I go, wow, you know, if I had to beat that old man, you know, maybe I'd be playing pool still. But pool is a miserable lifestyle if you think about it. You're down in a basement all the time. There's kind of seedy characters, a lot of really, really dishonest people, a lot of cheaters and crooks, and sure, it's certainly some nice people.
It's a good prep for the wine industry.
Yeah, it was something. Anyway, we got off on a weird tangent there. But, you know, then I worked in this French restaurant called Charlemagne. I learned about service, and I learned about wine, and I learned about, we did tableside service, tableside salads, things like that. And I drank my first white Burgundy, a Pouligny Malmaché from Joseph Drouin. And up to that point, I think I drank Matus. If I went on a date or something like that, I'd either buy Lancers or Matus, right?
Right, which is just cheap wine for people who don't know what that is.
It's rosé with sugar in it. And I'd go, I'd be like, yeah, it came in a ceramic bottle. And that was my idea of what wine was. And then when I tasted this wine, it exploded in my mouth. And I think I always liked to eat and drink. I didn't have much when I was a kid. And so like really good food was really something that I enjoyed. And then wine, it seemed like, really exploded on my palate, and I was really interested in it, and I really didn't have a career. So I said, well, I'll decide to be a wine guy now. I want to be a wine guy. And so I started reading wine books. And as I started to read, at that point, I thought I had low to average intelligence. I didn't really have a lot of self-esteem. And by studying for the court, it turned out that I had a knack for assimilating data and reading quickly and remembering things. And I just read and I read and I read, and I became better at what I did. I studied service books constantly. I got any kind of material that I could, and I didn't even know anything about the quartermaster sommeliers. And so I was working at this dog sledding log cabin restaurant in Snowmass Village. And it turned out that we became pretty famous out there. We had some real talent out there, and we were sold out like 30 days out. You know, you couldn't even get in there. I had David Bowie on the waiting list. Trump used to come in, had to put him on a waiting list. You couldn't get in there, and it was crazy, and I learned a lot about that. And in 93, I saw an ad for the Quartermaster Sommeliers, and I didn't know anything about it at all. I didn't have any idea what the Quartermaster Sommeliers was, but I liked wine. And I talked my friend Damon Ornowski, who was working at a steakhouse called Pinions, to go over to Vail and take this introductory class for the Quartermaster Sommeliers. And it was, you know, an eye-opener for all of us. At that time, we had no idea that we would become master sommeliers. As a matter of fact, we had no hope of even attempting that. We just thought it was cool. And we like wine. And the teachers were fantastic. Actually, Fred might have been there. Doug Frost was there. And it exposed me to all sorts of different things. And I was going, this is so cool.
At this point, though, how big is the Quartermaster Sommeliers? It's tiny, right? I mean,
oh, there was only 20 Americans. That's something like that. 25 Americans at that point, maybe. You know, very small American chapter. You know, nobody really even knew about it. That fall, they used to have a thing called the Sterling School of Service and Hospitality. And Evan Goldston ran that program with Fred Dame because they both worked for Seagram's. And it was basically kind of a mini wine class based on MS guys. And it was a week-long class. And so we took this class, and Dame and I went there with some guys from Aspen. And the class fascinated me. They had a test when it was all said and done. I think I got the second highest score in the class. And I was bummed out because I found out that they gave $1,000 out to the winner. And I was out drinking with the boys till like 3 a.m. And if I would have known there was money on the line, I would have been reading my books instead of drinking bourbon. But hindsight's easy, right? But the class was great. And then that next summer, I took the advanced course and I studied night and day. I read, that's all I did is read wine books and study and blind taste. And Damon and I took the advanced exam in 1994 and we passed first time. And that was the first time that I actually thought that I could become a master. I had no hopes prior to that, but I thought, wow, if I can pass this at 60%, I only have to be 15% better to pass the master's. But that's an old fallacy that you learn the hard way, that it is not fit. That 15% is hard earned, and it gets a little bit tougher. The next year was 1995, and I went to San Francisco to take the master's exam, and I just got shattered. I mean, I had the worst score of all time, and I was rattled and unsure of myself, and I had an anxiety attack. And when they gave me my results, they said, this program is probably not for you. Please don't say anything bad about the Master Sommeliers. So basically, quit the program and don't badmouth anybody. And, you know, and I was pretty stunned because I had worked so hard and I...
And you wanted it so bad, too.
I mean, well, I thought I had a shot, and in reality, I didn't. I got this, I offered. When we go offered, right, we have three parts, and we had 0-0-0.
Right.
And we had a big dinner for everybody, the students and the masters afterwards, and I was just devastated. And I actually sat next to Fred Dame, and I hadn't really known Fred except for the one time he'd come into my restaurant, and I said, you know, you guys basically beat me down, destroyed me, made me feel horrible. And he looked at me and he says, pick up your chin, kid. He says, look around the room. He says, you're in the room with the greatest sommeliers in the world. He said, you should be proud just to be here. You should be honored just to be here. He says, suck it up and quit your crying and get back to work. And I went, thank you, and did. And so I studied for another straight year, and I went to Las Vegas, and I took the master's exam in the spring and took theory down hard. I think I had a pretty good score with theory, but I was really, really nervous, and I couldn't look the panel in the eyes. So every time they asked me a question, I looked at the ceiling so I wouldn't have to look at them. And the chairman of the organization, Barry Larvin, was my panel chair, and he was actually the one the year prior to that told me to quit the program. Ira Harmon was in the room with him, and when I left the room, he looked up at the ceiling and said, are all the correct answers written on the ceiling? I had a really good tasting. This time I didn't look at anybody again. I put the spit bucket on the floor. I had the whole panel laughing. I crushed the blind tasting. And then I had like 5 minutes left, and I decided that the red wine number 5, I had called Saint-Emilion, I think 92 Saint-Emilion. And for some reason, you know, it blew Cab Franc, so it had that Cab Franc smell to it. And for some foolish reason, I decided to change the Saint-Emilion call to Chinon from the Loire Valley and failed myself.
Cab Franc, you know, you're going Cab
Franc.
Well,
I was good. I mean, it wasn't a bad call, but the bottom line is I lost the points that I needed and I failed tasting where I had it. And they told me that I had passed prior to that, but I gave it away. And then I went into service, and I walked into a full room humidor, and they had cigar service back then, and I just butchered cigar service. I had no idea, because the time before that, it was in San Francisco, you couldn't smoke. Now I'm in a humidor, I went down like a sack of bricks there. But when they gave me my results, it turned out that I was within points of service and tasting, and I had a good score with theory. And it was rewarding to me that I got one part. At that time, you could take the exam in America and in Europe, and they were having an exam in November at the Dorchester Hotel in London, England. And my mentor friend, Jim Sandner, called me up on the phone. This is prior to cell phones. And he said, Jay, I want you to take this exam. He says, I have some miles that are going to expire, and I want to send you there. I'll take care of the airfare. You need to do this. And I said, Jim, I'm not going to do this. I was afraid. I'd never been overseas. I was afraid of failure. I had no self-confidence anymore, and I had let my body erode to the point of studying so much over the winter that I was sick of being not fit. I said, no, I'm not going to study, and I don't want to study, and I'm going to take it again next year. And he says, no, you know, you need to do this. This is an opportunity for you here, and you should do this. And I have these miles that are going to expire, which was a total lie. And, you know, he was going to send me to London. So I said, no, I said I wasn't going to do it. And he says, well, call me back if you want. And so I have a place that I hike up on Aspen Mountain way up high, and I sit up there kind of cross-legged and think about everything. And I was all troubled, and I sat up there and I said, you need to do this. You know, opportunity only comes your way. You're a coward. You're a coward and a weakling and a loser. You will take opportunity. You will do this. And so I called him back up and I said, all right, I'm going to go. But I was also realized that I lacked self-confidence. So I had to write this little thing on my notebook that, you know, practice makes perfect. Confidence is all. Believe in yourself. And I read that every single day, 4 to 5 times. Practice makes perfect. Confidence is all. Believe in yourself. So I studied really, really, really hard. And I told myself that I wasn't going to be afraid anymore, and I wasn't going to be nervous in the exam, and I was going to accept my fate. And I went to London, and I passed. And I became the 30th American to pass the exam. And it was quite an experience. And a funny little side note to that, my friend Jim Sander was my mentor, had an office in London. And he says, Jay, I'm going to send you and my wife at the time to Claridge's, and Claridge's was very, very expensive, right? And this is the place, this the Sheik stayed and the greatest movie star stayed, and it was really, really expensive. And he said to me, he says, this is what you're going to do. I'm going to buy you dinner. And he says, I want you to sit in the lounge and order a bottle of champagne and peruse the menu. And then I want you to sit down and have a couple bottles of wine for dinner. And then they have the greatest cigar trolley and port cart. So he says, then I want you to have a Cuban cigar and a glass of vintage port and cheese, right? So that's what it says. He was a big cheese guy, right? So I said to myself, well, if I pass the exam, I'll go to Claridge's and let him pop. And if I fail the exam, I'll cancel because I'm not worthy. So I go in there and I do exactly what I said. We sit there and they kind of treated me like an American tourist. You know, there was a bunch of English blue bloods in pinstripe suits with pocket squares and sipping their wine with their noses up. And the sommelier was a big, heavyset guy in a tuxedo with white gloves. And he waited on us kind of somewhat reluctantly and was okay. And we had a really nice dinner. And so it's my first night in the world as a master somm. And I went to the bathroom before my port and my cigar. And my wife told the somm that I'd passed the master's exam. And I came back into the dining room, and in the middle of Claridge's, this stuffy dining room, this heavy-set guy in a tuxedo drops to his knees and bows to me. And he goes, Master Fletcher, he goes, I am so sorry. He goes, I did not know. And he bows to me again. He says, I have tried to pass the master's 5 times and have never passed a part. He says, I am so embarrassed that I did not treat you more respectful and with more honor. And I almost puked, right? I just went, wah. I mean, the whole thing just blew my mind. I mean, everybody's looking at him. He bowed to me in the middle of Claridge's on my first night as a master. How crazy is that?
Oh, so good. Unbelievable. I mean, how do you not get a big head after that?
I don't know, but yeah, I was just in awe.
Yeah. Jay, I've had some of the best bottles of wine in my life with you. This is a huge honor to have this conversation. I mean it. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Sorry, I got kind of off on a out of tangent story there.
Wine is a tangent. That is a fact.
You know, the whole thing, Journey's been a great run. I mean, that was 23 years ago. And since then, my experiences around the world, my exposure to a fine product, and I think I've gotten better because my life, you know, really went from a guy that, you know, I slept in ditches. I slept in back of U-Haul sometimes. I'd sleep, you know, I would eat on $5 for weeks. I was really had nothing. And then when I see how much I have now, and it's all because of wine, you know, I was a busboy. I was a back waiter. I was a front waiter. And if you put your mind to it and you put your head down, great, great things can happen. And I've been so fortunate to watch so many of my students become great human beings, great teachers, great wine people, just great people through hard work and discipline. It really, really makes me feel good to see what we've done, and the camaraderie with it has just been fantastic. So it's been a great run for me, and I hopefully will continue to experience life and learn and teach more.
I want to thank you all for tuning into the podcast, and please make sure you go to SOMTV.com, sign up for updates there. Go to SOMFoundation.com to take a look at their scholarships and all their enrichment trips. Please subscribe to this. Please rate it. Please review. Please tell your aunt and your dog and your cousin about this podcast. See you guys again next time.